further ado, Stacy Yu.
Hi, my name is Stacy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Stacy.
Thank you, Patrick. Right back at you. Hello out in virtual land. That is often me. I am often on the virtuals listening to all of you. I am primary caregiver to my parents who are 90 and 85. So I've been very isolated, which has probably been great. I'm almost 60, so it's probably good for me too. But I sure do miss the in unison stuff. And I sure do miss the hugs or the elbow bumps that I get. I just miss that terribly. And it's just so good to see all of you in person tonight. So thank you so much, Patrick, for giving me that opportunity. And thank you again for setting this up, the whole thing. It's just been a really huge service, I know, to me and many others who are kind of housebound. So I have been sober for 33 years. So let's just start there. So I've been sober longer than I drank. And what that means is I know less and less. There's a thing that often you'll hear is the road gets narrower. And what that means to me, I always kind of visualize a mountain pass with weedy edges, and that the path is indeed getting narrower. And while I used to traipse off into the woods and the meadows and beyond and get off the path and then kind of find my way back, I have found probably in the last 10 years for sure that that is no longer an option for me. I need to keep my life pretty straight and narrow, which means what? That means that what I say I'm going to do, I do. That means I put the grocery cart back in the parking lot, right? It's that combo platter of big things and little things. But what it means at its core is I no longer get to act like a drunk person, right? Because I'm still an alcoholic. That has not changed. I think I was an alcoholic for a very long time. I definitely know. I started drinking for sure at 5. I would steal the cream de menthe out of the liquor cabinet and drink it, and I loved it, and I knew enough at 5 to put water back in there so my parents would know, right? And it was sort of heartbreaking. I have 3 kids, a stepdaughter and then 2 sons with my husband, and when they turned 5, it broke my heart to realize that at that age, I needed to escape, that there was something fundamentally different from my fellows at 5. And it just escalated. I'm an only child, and so I escaped first into the world of books. I just loved books and stories. Thus, I love speaker meetings, right? I love hearing your stories. I fell in love with speaker meetings. Thank goodness for speaker meetings. First books, and I was a chubby, glasses-wearing, isolated kind of girl, you know, so I didn't have a lot of friends. Then I went to school, teacher's pet, blah, blah, blah. My parents, I always really thought surely somebody would come along soon and rescue me and take me to perhaps the tower, the princess tower, where maybe I would be happy. I don't really recall being unhappy or happy in my childhood. I was just kind of waiting to get away. Was always the overriding thing for me is I wanted it to be different. I wanted to go away. That has manifested itself even now, sober this long and at my age, is that I love to travel and I love to learn new things. You know, that always that right now, it's a struggle a little bit even now to be here now, which is where meditation comes in and prayer. And so I'll get to that. So I lost the chub by becoming a swimmer. I was a pom-pom girl, and I shredded my things. I was a pom-pom girl, and that was kind of fun. But I was never actually popular per se. I did do theater, though. And as a theater major, I had the best time being other people. It was the perfect thing for me. And I decided to go to college up at Northwestern in Chicago for theater. And what had happened is I grew up in Wichita, Kansas, so a little north of here is Wichita, Kansas, right? And I grew up there, and there's nothing to do in Wichita, Kansas. There's not. And so what we would do as teenagers is we would, I'm going to age myself now, we would put in our 8-track tapes and drag Douglas with our beer and our wine, right? And we'd, right? And come home and sneak in the back door and go to bed quietly. And it was then that I realized that was the only thing I never, that I had to stop drinking before I stopped drinking was tequila. And I used to say I just put too much orange juice in my tequila one night and it just ruined it for the rest of the time. It was like the only time I was uber sick. So when I got to college, it was a work hard, play hard school that suited me just great. I was very functional for a long time in terms of I got good grades and I showed up to things until the end. So what happened in college is I had a few blackouts. Like I definitely remember running up the main street of Evanston with no clothes on. I was just hot. I think I was just hot. That thing and kind of waking up and not knowing the person really who I was next to. So that was always kind of interesting, you know? But I managed, right? I managed to do quite well in college, and then I decided to stay in Chicago because I did not want to go home. And one of the things I do want to say is that it is possible to care for your parents even though you don't like them. I don't really like my parents. I've never really liked them. It's not that they're awful. They just don't believe the same things I do, and they're very sure they are right. And they kind of pull the master switch for me of annoyance. And so I will tell you this time frame where I've been their primary caregiver and going over and cooking them dinner and making sure they're taking their meds and getting them to the doctor and doing these things that we do out of love and service. I realize that I can carry an opinion and still take the right action. And to me, that is sobriety in action, is that I am able to, you know, every once in a while they're kind of fun, you know, they're okay. And if I can get mom by herself, she's okay. And dad, it's just the two of them together create quite a conundrum for me that I just don't like them. And it's stressful for me. And so I do other things to help balance that out. I do my meditation. I'm looking at my sponsee Dorsey because she's the best meditator ever. And I'm learning from her. I do my meditation. I swim. I go for long walks. I pet my dog. I do these things that keep me in balance. I listen to meetings that have allowed me to continue to be of service to my parents and not let them know my opinion of them very often. And that's a huge gift and a miracle as far as I'm concerned. So I'm in college, and so I don't want to go home because I don't like my parents. And I didn't get into a theater program I wanted to get into for the summer theater. And so what I did was is I decided to go to Russia. Because that's what you do, right? You go to Russia. It was called Camping and Driving in the USSR. It was still the USSR then. And it was a group of people. And I was speaking Russian because I had been I was in an econ class, and I didn't understand that you needed math for econ. And so I needed to drop that immediately. And the only thing available in the time slot was Russian. So I had learned Russian, and I do like languages. I'm actually learning Greek right now because I'm going on a Greek swim trip. I am going on a Greek swim trip in October. So I love languages. But anyway, so I spoke a little bit of Russian. And I got on this trip, and it was 8 weeks, and you started in Amsterdam and drove Helsinki all the way down through the Russian, down into the Caucasus Mountains, out over the Black Sea, and then we went our three separate VW vans. We went our three separate ways. So I went through Romania and Czechoslovakia, and then Prague, and then into Berlin. And so I was the driver, which was not a good idea, because for me, what I subsisted on in Russia was vodka, pickles, and bread. Vodka, pickles, and bread, with the occasional pivo, which is the beer, but it was bad beer. But so mostly vodka, pickles, and bread. And so I was you have these visas, and you're supposed to get through the country, and this was still when it was East Germany and West Germany. And so we were supposed to get through East Germany by a certain time. And I was driving very loaded. And so we didn't actually make our cutoff. So then we had to go to the nearest gate, which happened to be the Brandenburg Gate, which you're not supposed to go through. And I was really close to being arrested for driving A, drunk, and B, not being under our visa. I was very close, but the guy took pity on us and let us through. And, you know, of course, what did I do when I got on the other side? I laughed about it, right? Got away with another thing. Later, in sobriety, I realized that's one of those seconds and inches. I've heard speakers talk about the fact that we get to these rooms by seconds and inches. Like, we don't step off the curb and the bus goes by, right? Those are the kind of things, you know, waking up in the beds that you don't know who they are or why you're there. You know, those seconds and inches, I think we all have that commonality. And I will say, by the way, please, if you're newish, listen to the similarities, not the differences. I might not be telling your story, but you know what? We're all alcoholics, and our approach to life is remarkably similar. So I got out of college, but what happened that I skipped over, interestingly, is when I was on this trip and just subsisting on bread, pickles, and vodka, I came very close to committing suicide. It had been raining for weeks and weeks and weeks. I had been chased by feral pigs through an orchard. You know, it just wasn't the glam trip you'd want to have. And, you know, it's just... And so we were in, I think, Sochi or Suhumi, I forget. But anyway, there's big cliffs and a pounding black sea underneath and very, you know, Heathcliff emotional. And I had been drinking, and imagine that. And I just wandered to the edge of the cliff, and I had this moment, and this is what I always love to make sure I say. I absolutely had the moment where it was clear as a bell that it would be better off, the world would be definitely better off without me in it. And it was such a pure thought. It was one of the purest thoughts I had had in a long time. And it, the bells, right? What happened for me was, is I had had a friend, and he, as I was tipping over the cliff, because I was very committed to this action, I was tipping over the cliff, he grabbed the back of my coat and pulled me back in. And what I think is important about that is two things. First of all, it does really, I get that it feels like a good idea. I really, at core, the next day was better is the biggest thing I took away. That the next day, things were just a little better. I had dysentery, so I was really thin, and like I was the thinnest I had ever been, and that felt really good. I know, it's so shallow, but it's like, it was just these little things, right, that the next day was better, and so that's what I would say to you. If you're having a rough go, please, you know, talk to somebody, or just know that tomorrow is definitely better. It would be my message to you. So we got home. That is where, though, I think I crossed the line. You know, I hear a lot of people talking about, you know, when did I become an alcoholic? I drank alcoholically for a long time, but I think living on bread, pickles, and vodka for 8 weeks was my line. And then once you cross that line and become a pickle, you can't go back to being a cucumber ever again. It's just not possible. I crossed a line. I still managed to get along for a while. I moved to Los Angeles to become an actress, so of course I was a waitress. Went on a lot of auditions, encountered the whole Me Too thing, but navigated it, right? I navigated because that's what we do as alcoholics. You know, we're very adept at lying. At that point, I would rather tell you a lie than tell you the truth. It was just easier on me. And what happened was is that I missed a performance. I missed an acting performance. I had gone and seen Fatal Attraction, and they drink a lot of red wine in that movie, so I went home that afternoon because I used to love to go to matinees by myself and sneak stuff in. And so I had drunk too much red wine, and I didn't wake up in time to go to the theater. So I had missed a performance, so that was kind of, I was starting to have consequences. I had a hit and run where I bumped somebody's car and left, but they were mad, and so I had that a little bit of a bump there. The last thing that happened was as I was driving home from a rehearsal, and I was using the braille way of driving, right? You kind of go, bum, and you know, you need to come back this way. So I was getting, I was fine. I was a good driver. And I got pulled over, right, by the cops. And so I had the wine bottle, like, right there, because I'm a wino. I don't know if I said that. I'm a total wino. That was my drug of choice, was wine. Two or three bottles a night. And so the twist-top kind. High-end. And so they pulled me over. I did the sobriety test just fine. I did the walking just fine. I did the backwards counting just fine. Amazing. I did the alphabet just fine. Then they had me blow, and I blew a 2. And so they sent me to jail. And I was in there with the strippers and the hookers. We all got along fine. And it was fine. The problem was is that I had already had the one thing. And that meant that I actually needed to go they were going to send me to Sybil Brand, which was an unpleasant prison downtown Los Angeles at the time. And I knew very well that I would not do well in Sybil Brand, that I would not fare well. And I was scared. And my roommate, who's a goody-goody, got wind of this, and she did an intervention with my parents and a bunch of people, and I was so embarrassed because my dad cried, and I was just sort of horrified, and these people were saying, oh, I think you'd be, and I'm like, you don't even know my life. To backtrack just a minute, I had tried going to AA prior to this intervention. So this was in October. I had started going to meetings in January. I had been tricked by one of my fellow waiters. He said he had a book club that he went to that he thought I might like. And, you know, I said, it's not a Bible one, is it? And he goes, no, not a Bible one. He was my Eskimo. And he took me to the log cabin. If any of you guys know Los Angeles meetings, the log cabin, it was a very boisterous place, and it was an Architects of Adversity meeting, which means you're smoking, and you're, like, yelling, and people standing on tables and chairs throwing. I loved it, right? It was like, this is great. But I couldn't stay sober. And so what happened in that interim between January and October is I was trying to get sober. I was going to meetings, especially speaker meetings, because I found them highly entertaining. But I couldn't figure out how not to drink. I was having real trouble with steps 2 and 3, because I didn't believe in God at the time at all. I had been raised Methodist, and it just wasn't working for me. And I just couldn't do that part. I did take chips, though. Yeah, they gave chips for 30 days, 60 days. And I'd raise my hand, and I'd take that 30-day chip, and they'd applaud, and I'd sit down. And I even had a sponsor. She was a really mean sponsor. She's still my sponsor today. Super mean. Wouldn't let me share. I had so much to share, and she wouldn't let me share. She wouldn't let me be funny. She said, you're just mean. And I'm like, you're mean. I didn't say that, but I thought it. And she was right. Of course she was right. She was a step Nazi. I'm like, oh, for gosh sakes. I had picked her, full honesty. I had picked her because she was a famous actress who wore great clothes, drove a great car, and was dating the guy I thought I should be dating. So they say, you know, when you're looking for a sponsor, pick somebody who has what you want. Right? I was following directions. So that's the backstory. So I decide to go to this, the intervention happened. I'm like, fine. It's right. I had been really drunk on Everclear like the night before. So that was helpful in terms of I needed a rest. And so I kind of thought of it. I'll just go. I'll appease these people. It might look good so I don't have to go to Sybil Brand that I did this thing. It was very, I was very devious about it one more time. I'm the same person still who put water in the cream de menthe. That person is still the person I was. I hadn't grown from there. I still thought lying was definitely the way to go with a lot of things, or pulling the wool over, or acting like this. Like, I love that term, act as if. I'm like, I can act as if. I just didn't get it. This is what happened to me in Minnesota. It was snow, it was awful. And they put me in a room with three girls. So I didn't like any of them. And they wouldn't leave me alone. What happened was is they made us get into groups. And back then, this was back a long time ago now, and they did not have dual diagnosis yet. So a lot of people who were mentally ill were also in places like a sobriety to get sober place, and it wasn't a good fit. So one of these really crazy people had shared in this meeting, and it was the first time I had identified, this guy's brain was like my brain. What he was talking about, his worldview, which was very dark, I'm like, yeah, somebody who gets me. So they make you play volleyball in the snow at this place in groups. And so I was so tortured, right? It was about a weekend, and this guy had chair, and I'm like, huh, you know. So we're playing, and then we hear screaming over on that end. So we stop what we're doing. We run around. And the guy I had identified with had taken his belt, hung himself from a tree, and I watched him die. All the sound went out of the world. And I realized, I saw spirit, because he was a person struggling, and then he was like a doorknob. So I understood spirit for the first time right then, that we do have one. And I also knew that could have been me. That there was zero difference between that drunk and this drunk, except that one wasn't going to see sunrise. So I went into the cornfield that was nearby, and I knelt down in the snow and the dead corn, and I looked up at this leaden sky, and I said, I don't believe in you. But if you can keep me from doing that, I will stay sober one day at a time. And I meant it. And it was the first time I'd gotten down on my knees in a long time. So that night, you know, we went to bed, and they didn't really have counseling or anything. It's nothing. And I woke up the next day, and it was the first time since I was 26 then. It was the first time since I had been around 12 or 13 that I didn't crave a drink. And it wasn't until probably a couple years later that my sponsor was able to point out to me that that had been my spiritual experience. I don't recommend that one. But it was mine. And I got, what it did for me is it humbled me in a way that I could start following directions. I could start to realize that there was a power greater than myself, that I could start to believe that. And I hunted that one down. I did Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. I did Buddhism. I did The Secret. I did so many things to try and find God. And I've kind of still done that. It's an ongoing process. But what I definitely know, and I definitely don't know a lot of things, like I said, the longer I'm sober, the less I know. I know for sure I'm not in charge. There was a man who went to meetings, and he used to talk, and he was an atheist. He was just a dedicated atheist. And he used to say he would start his mornings in the shower pressing against the walls, just pressing against the walls, and he knew if his hands didn't push through, he was going to not be in charge that day. And I hung on to that one for a long time, and I think that's why meetings are so important, is you'll hear these odd things that you'll remember and you'll take with you, and it will pop into your brain when you need it. There was another guy who used to go to the ocean and tell the ocean to stop coming in, and it wouldn't, and so he knew he was not as big as the ocean. You know, there's definitely ways, if you're struggling, as I did for a long time with two and three, there's definitely ways in. What happened when I went back to meetings once I had completed my 30-day course? By the way, the courts had a glitch and lost my paperwork, so I didn't have to go to jail. Thank you. Right? Thank you. I needed that one. God does know what you can handle, and that was definitely not on my agenda. I went back to meetings and I told my spine, she knew, and she was like, okay. She said, well, do you have 30 days now? And I said, yeah, I do. She said, then go up and tell the truth. I'm like, oh man, that's a hard one. But I did. They called for chips just like Patrick did. And I went up and I took the 30-day chip and I said, I was lying to you before. I wasn't sober any of those times, but this is real. And that room did what this room would do, too. You guys went, yay, yay. And I was like, oh, my gosh. And for the first time, I believe the thing that you say, which is we will love you until you can love yourself. Because being the cynic I was when I came in, I'm like, yeah, that's right. You know, first of all, why would I want to love myself? And second of all, why would I let you love me? Anyway, but you know, it was true. They loved me and they were kind to me. And my sponsor made me start working the steps right away for real. And we did. And I took commitments. And so I went very quickly through the first three. My sponsor pointed out to me that I had been taking a searching and fearless moral inventory of everybody else for like ever. I'm like, okay. So I did that for myself. We sat together, she made salad, and I sat and told her all of my horrible things, except for one horrible thing that I just didn't think she is too white for. She's too white. And I decided instead to, I did tell her, I said, I've got this one thing I don't want to tell you. And she said, you sure? I probably, you know, I'm like, no. She said, okay, then you need to tell someone. And so what I did is I went down to Skid Row where I was, there was a meeting down there that I loved. I made the peanut butter jelly and sandwiches there for like years because I loved that meeting so much. And I found a guy on a bench, just some guy, some random guy. And I said, hey, I'm an Alcoholics Anonymous and I have a secret, but I can't have secrets. Can I tell it to you? And he's like, yeah. Right? And so I told him and he went, whoa. And I said, so we're good. And he goes, yeah. Like with this whole newfound respect in his eyes, right? And that's how I got rid of my secrets. So if you need to, please go down to Skid Row and tell a guy. It'll make their day, right? So I did that. I was entirely ready. 6 and 7 were very okay for me. Making a list of people was hard. I actually liked that. I like having... I'm this weird... I'm a creative who's anal. And so for me to create a list is actually really fun for me. So I did the list. I became willing. It was really pointed out to me by my sponsor that I needed to go slow on that one. That making the list was fine, and I should make it as long as possible. And it was, you know, how much money. And she said, we'll start with the easy one. She said, but when you're getting to those ones that could harm others, she said, we need to talk about each one of those. Because I still had a very sharp tongue. I was still very funny at your expense. That has calmed remarkably. I'm rarely funny even in my head. I can be a little snarky. But mostly... not out loud to you, and actually rarely in my, I just don't think that way anymore. But we did go kind of slowly through there. I did do the direct amends. I love continue to take personal inventory. I think that's where I grew the most as a human being. Learning about restraint of pen and tongue was huge. I was in the film industry, right? I always did pretty well in the film industry. And, I always used to say, you know, I was a bunch of sharks, it really is. I would put on my dolphin hat and swim with them, right? And pretend. After a while, though, that's an example of the road getting narrower. I could no longer be in that industry. I really had to realize that I could not function as a sober woman in that industry and keep my sobriety by what was required of me in terms of, I was in production, so it was a lot of lying for people. And I just couldn't do it anymore. So, thought through prayer and meditation. I'm still working on that. What I did really well, only because I was told to, is I did a lot of service work in the first 10 years of my sobriety. Went to Chino, which is a young men's prison, the training ground, they say, to become a real criminal. I took a panel out there for years. We were in some lockdowns, like something would happen. They put us in a cell, me and the other three people, and we'd be in the jail cell chatting until they let us out, right? It was a remarkable, going to insane asylums, which I feel like I skirted that edge too. I loved the sound of the door closing because I was on the outside of it. Because I think I was really close, and even in sobriety, you know, we can be wackadoodle, right? We can be crazy town. And, you know, just for a moment, the experiences of this particular week, can we just pause a minute and say, whoo, howdy. This has been a week and a half. And these are the kind of turbulent times. You know, there's that old saying, right, that if you curse someone, you wish they lived in interesting times. I think we've all been cursed. But how do I respond to that now as a sober woman is very different than I did in early sobriety. In early sobriety, I would have been all in it. I am not all in it. I'm like, I'm observant of it. I try and do my part in terms of being kind where I'm at. But I try not to let it in anymore. Whereas before, I had been numb for so long that any sort of excitement was really helpful for me to feel. I couldn't feel anything in early sobriety. I didn't know. I would go to a party, right, and kind of stand in the back because I couldn't be funny. So I didn't know what to do with myself. I would stand in the back, and but later, about 3 days later, I'd go, I think I had fun. I think maybe I had fun. I had to learn to do my dishes in sobriety. Like, I didn't how do I do all these dishes? I'd call my sponsor. And she said, you know, why don't you try one dish? It was a huge deal. I'm like, okay, you know, and do that one dish. And okay, that one's clean. And so from all of this input, and I went to 7 to 9 meetings a week for the first 10 years of my sobriety because I was that sick. I took commitments. Like I said, I made the peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. I went and took the panels. I spoke when asked. I sponsored. I'm a bad sponsor for the most part. Better now, right, Dorsey? I tend to do much better being of service in a different way, and that's okay. You'll find your path too. What happened, to sort of fast forward to now, is while I was doing all that stuff, I went to a lot of meetings, and at a meeting, there was this guy sharing about how he had walked his little daughter to first grade, and she had never seen him take a drink, and I'm like, that's awesome. So I went and met him, and his last name makes me a rhyming name. And I was like, I'm not going to marry him, is what I thought. 4 months later, we got married. We've been married for, we're in our 26th year of marriage to each other in a row. And, and you know, it's pretty cool being married to another sober alcoholic, except when it's not. Okay, I'm just going to be really, it's sometimes he's more sober than me, and he can be super assy about it, man. And you know what? Same back at me. You know, when one finger's pointing out, like three are pointing back at you, that is for sure, you know, and he's watching, you know, love you. So I made dinner. I made this really nice dinner before I came tonight because I didn't know if I was going to mention him. He had a daughter, so I was a mom right away, and it was really hard being a stepmom. I used every ounce of sobriety I could use in that, and we're very good friends today, but it took a long time. Our boys, we raised our boys, and I will tell you, they never saw me drink either, right, or him. And so I was the cookie bacon, walk your kid to school room mom. I was on the PTA. I was that mom. The kids always loved coming to our house. This was not what I grew up with, and it was probably, and when I was looking at, you know, great things will come to pass, in my early sobriety, that was not what I was looking for. I was still trying to be an actress. I wanted the television series and the house and the gardeners, right? What I got was a really decent man and some really great kids that I could be a mom to. And I never, you know, I'm a swim mom. You know, I sit on the, I time those meets. You know, I got to do all those things, really invested with my kids. And what happens when you have two sober parents, at least it did in our household, is first of all, our oldest daughter ran away and we didn't see her for 2 years because she was doing meth under a bridge. So there's no guarantees. We had to let her go, and I really found my God at that point because I had to trust that she had one. And if she had a God that was looking after her because we couldn't, maybe I had one too. I grew a lot spiritually during those 2 years. Our two sons could not be more different. The oldest one is super excited because his new Glock just came in and he got his arm carry thing, right? That's what he's super excited about. The other one, and he's like libertarian, I don't know, he's very over there. The other one's way over there, left wing, left of Bernie, world traveler, you know? And so we raised these kids that have become themselves. That's what you get to do in sobriety, is allow, not stifle them, but allow them to be who they are. The daughter finally came home to us when we were living in Tennessee. We were in Tennessee for 10 years. Beautiful, beautiful Tennessee, Blue Ridge Mountains. She came to us very thin, not a lot of teeth left, scraggly hair. Her backpack was all that was left. And she showed up one day, and we said, of course, we love you. We understand. And she slept in our basement, and she got rid of all the judgments that were against her, and she went back to college. And we're just, she's great. She's maybe going to get married and have kids. I don't know. She lives out in Vegas. She's doing fine. Sober. Sober. So that's what happens when you are a sober person. The last thing I want to kind of talk about is tragedy in sobriety. We moved here to take care of my parents. My kids, all four, had gone off to college. Everybody was doing okay now. We had been living in Johnson City, Tennessee for 10 years. Beautiful place, 54,000 people. My husband's from Boston. Just not enough stuff for him. He said, I need a bigger city. I said, fine. What about Dallas? I'm an only child. I really think I need to take care of mom and dad. I'm feeling that kind of pull to do that. He said, fine. So we moved here into an apartment that we didn't want to move into. My parents had found it for us, because that's what they do. They had found us this apartment, and it was fine. It just wasn't quite what we wanted. It was a one bedroom, not two. Anyway, we were just like, fine. You know, we were trying really hard to just kind of go with the flow. We're coming here to do this wonderful thing. Aren't we just lovely humans? We had packed up or given away a ton of stuff. Pat moved cross country. The dog is like, what's going on? It was fine back there. Why are we coming here? And we moved in our stuff. We had unpacked all of our boxes. Last one, we had had dinner with my parents at the new place. Went to bed. And about an hour after they left, my dog, who's normally very mellow, is like going, burr, 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 next to me. I'm like, what the, shut up. I'm trying to sleep. I'm tired. I've been unpacking for days. She wouldn't stop, and because I'm a sharing person, I nudged my husband awake so he could go see what was going on, right? And he got up, and he came back. He said, I think the building's on fire. And I'm like, so tortured, right? I have my tortured face on. And I'm like, oh, God. You know, and so I don't know. And so I pull on some clothes, and he said, you might want to put on more clothes than that. It's kind of cold. I'm like, oh, fine. And we get the dog, and we have the clothes on. We lock the door, and between that, it had maybe been 5 minutes. Had nothing else. I got my purse, because you do as a girl. And it was so full of smoke, we couldn't see. And there were these two little ladies lived next to us, and we realized there was no way they were going to get down the stairs. And so my husband carried the two down the stairs. I found a little dog that was running around by itself, and you know the dogs before you know the people. I knew the dog, and so I picked up the dog and I took it downstairs. Our dog is like, can we please leave now after waking us up? And I go downstairs, and I'm so annoyed because I'm thinking smoke damage and I'm not going to get enough sleep tonight, and some weenie probably like put a lighter. And I give the dog to the woman it belonged to, and she's got tears streaming down her face. And I'm like, oh, for God's sake, you know, talk about drama. And she goes, everything's going. And I'm like, and she looked, and I looked, and the flames were like 7 feet tall, and the room we had just been in, the bedroom, not 30 seconds before, was crumbling. And it was the first 7-alarm fire in Dallas history, and everything we owned was destroyed that night, and asked me if I had insurance. Nah, No, I was going to go do that Monday. It was on my list. I just hadn't gotten to it yet. So we had been here 10 days. Everything burned everything. We lost everything except what we were wearing, even in the storage, because in the and the cars were everything. We lost everything. And we went to my parents' house, which is another ordeal. My dad told us to take off our clothes in the garage because we stunk of smoke. And he didn't want us in our in their house smelling that way. And so we just took it in stride. And the next day we went and looked, and it was definitely all gone. And what we did was, is we sat down at Starbucks, and we started making a list of what we might need. And the next thing we did is we went to Preston. I went to the women's meeting at Preston, and I sat there and did what I had been taught to do, which was be real and be sad. Because my sponsor had told me long ago, you cannot save your ass and your face at the same time. So I was crying. I had been to a couple times to that meeting before this. They came up to me. I was engulfed in the love that you find in these rooms. And my husband, same with the meeting. We go to separate meetings. We found over the time that works best for us. And we not once did we think about drinking, which didn't occur to us until later. What a flippin' miracle that is for two dyed-in-the-wool alcoholics to not think about drinking. We just thought about solution. We were into solution immediately, and we knew where to go to get it. Wasn't we were not going to be loved by my parents, and we had no friends. We knew no one else. I didn't even know where Target was. I'm like, I don't know where anything is. We knew where to go to be fed and loved and nurtured, which was here in these rooms. And that is sobriety in action, to know that. And it didn't even occur to us until weeks later that we hadn't even thought about taking a drink, because it was really clear the fire was not about us. The fire was the fire. It was an event that had nothing to do against us. It was just something we experienced. Since that time, we've really found our place here. Patrick, the traditional group, my group is Preston. I said, but my heart belongs to traditional. Because that's where I found the kind of people, just my tribe, man. It's just my tribe. It's just how it is. And I've been so grateful for AA here in Dallas, even though it's not really how we did it in LA. It's not how we did it in Tennessee. Dallas does it like Dallas. And it's perfect for here. What I've come to understand is you were sober long before I got here. I do not need to tell you how to stay sober. I do not. I need to show up, be a participant, say yes when I'm asked, and generally trying to live my life in accordance to these steps and to these traditions. Dorsey and I are going through the traditions right now, and it's just such a great deep dive into how to work with others in your life. If you haven't really looked at the traditions, I do recommend it. So that brings us to today. What I did today was I woke up when I was done sleeping, because it's Saturday. I had some coffee. My husband and I talked about what we needed to do today. My son had been in D.C., not in the crazy, but he had been traveling with friends, because that's where he went to college. He came back. He was still alive. That was good. I talked to a few friends. I made dinner for my family. I had a swim. A very simple life, but a very beautiful one. One that is kind of conflict-free for the most part, or if I do run into conflict, I know what to do. I have these steps to work through it. I no longer create conflict because I've learned pen and tongue rule. Like, just, just don't, And it took me a long time to realize that. But what I've come to mostly understand is that as your heart grows, you do become softer. And as you know less, there is more wonder in the world. And that is what I hope you all find. Thank you so much.